are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 16, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the legal justification for our bombing of Syria turns out to be a secret. Meanwhile, feds confirm they have recordings. And Trump wants to see Cohen's documents before the feds do, just to check. In a major antitrust faux pas, U.S. to allow Bayer to acquire Monsanto. And teacher protests and strikes continue in red states. Meanwhile, Democratic enthusiasm softens, but the Republicans have nothing but Trump. Federal court strikes down a Maryland law against generic drugs price gouging. And is the corporate education reform dead? I should say the movement dead. The Working Families Party endorses Cynthia Nixon, and major unions leave after Cuomo threatens them.
Big risk on their part, but necessary.
And a reminder, ICE, still horrible, ladies and gentlemen. All this and more on today's program. I am back from Las Vegas after biannual would be every 2 years. So it's the semi-annual torts conference that I attend there with lawyers and whatnot. One of the things I did not get to and could not coordinate with lawyers. Sometimes, like every couple of years, it's just I have one where it's just tricky. We had a couple of cancellations on Friday. And fortunately, I had done some pre-tapes. But I wanted to get one of the lawyers who is involved in suing Monsanto over the possibility that glyphosate, I'm not pronouncing that right, I know that, but it's the active ingredient in Roundup, the pesticide Roundup, is carcinogenic. And the World Health Organization said that, came out with a, it wasn't a definitive verdict. It said it was, the herbicide is probably carcinogenic. This is the key ingredient in Roundup. And then, of course, Monsanto's business plan is built upon this idea of Roundup as you have, they create seeds with a genetically modified plant that is resistant to the herbicide Roundup so that everything around it dies. But I guess, you know, we're going to see before you send me a bunch of tweets and complaints that I don't believe in science. I think it's quite possible that things cause cancer, chemicals cause cancer. And in reporting that there's a court case and that the World Health Organization said that it's probably carcinogenic, I don't. You have nothing to complain about.
The World Health Organization is going to be researching astrology next.
Exactly. I mean,
ridiculous.
So ridiculous. We should have
the notion that Monsanto might be dishonest about its own internal reporting on its products, please. Anti-science.
More than 300 lawsuits have been filed on behalf of farmers and others who said that Roundup gave them cancer. And so we will find out more. We'll dig into that. I'll definitely get somebody next time I'm in at that conference, but maybe we'll get somebody before then. And if not on this program, then on Ring of Fire. Folks, are you tired of seeing ads when you want to read the news? I know I am, because that's all I do is read the news and have to see these. There are about half the sites I go to, there's like automatic video rolls, which drive me insane.
Freeze the site.
One of the ways I get my news, I get it from social media. The problem is sometimes you miss some stuff because you just don't know if you have curated the proper reporters, let's say, on Twitter and certainly on Facebook. I don't even go on Facebook. I'm not even going to go. I just don't do that. And in these days, that feeling that you might be missing out on breaking news, understandable, because it seems like you have legitimate breaking news every half an hour. Now you can download Smart News for free in the Apple Store or the Google Play Store. Get your news in real time from over 300 trusted sources. CNN, Vice, Politico, HuffPost, The Hill, more. Smart News' algorithm automatically curates the must-read stories that matter now. So you can get your news in just 1 minute. Plus, you can read the news wherever you go, even when you're offline. No wonder Smart News already has more than 25 million users worldwide. I got to say, the thing I like about it, I consume more news than your average individual. But the value to me for something like Smart News is that I get stuff that I have not pre-selected. Some of this stuff is news that I wouldn't. I have my own biases in terms of what kind of news I want. And sometimes I see news that I didn't know that I wanted to know. That becomes valuable, and I will share it with you folks. Smart News is available for free in the App Store or the Google Play Store. Check it out now. Before we get into some of the stories about Syria and what's going on with those teacher protests, in addition to starting to begin be a little bit more conscious of elections that are taking place in what now? 5 months? 7 months. But this story I found completely heartwarming, and I'm sure you'll understand after I read it. It is from the Washington Monthly, written by Rachel Cohen. It's the story of Alex Tabarrok. He is an economist at George Mason University. George Mason University, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to think about the economists that are there. Yes, he is a libertarian. George Mason is a hotbed of libertarianism. And as such, it is they are awash in Koch brothers' money. In fact, I think it's out of George Mason University where there is a program which then turns around and subsidizes some of Dave Rubin's videos, if I'm not corrected. Something like the Liberty Project or something. Now, of course, this guy, Alex Tabarrok, has written very favorably of private prisons, private airports, even private cities. When Tabarrok and his former grad student, Nathan Goldschlag, set out to measure how federal regulations impact businesses' growth, well, you can imagine what they thought they were going to find. I mean, how many times? Now, look. For me, the value in government regulation is not that it's going to help businesses grow. And to me, it's not even, I don't even rarely bring up the idea, the notion that like, well, it doesn't hurt businesses that much. Because I don't care. The point of government regulation, and I don't believe in all government regulations, I think you can have stupid regulations. Or ones that were well-intentioned and turned out to be bad, and so you should change those. But the primary reason why you have government regulation is because the business of business is to do business and to maximize their profits. And so you need to inhibit their ability to externalize their costs onto us in the form of lack of safety, lack of health, destruction of the commons. So he does this study, these two, Tabarrok and Nathan Goldschlag, because apparently the Center for Study of Public Choice.
Yes. That is the quintessential serious libertarian title
yes.
right there.
That's at great. George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Mercatus, of course, Latin for market. It is heavily funded by Charles Koch and Richard Fink, a former Koch Industries executive. So it's not just all Koch money. It's money that someone earned while working for the Koch
brothers. It's also former Koch money.
Right. So Tabarrok is the director for the Center of Public Choice and an economics chair at the Mercatus Center. And in 2014, two other Mercatus Center research fellows developed a new type of database, really not even a new type of database, but a database called Reg Data. Way to look into the implications of regulations. It captures everything published in the Code of Federal Regulations each year. And it also uses AI to predict which industry each regulation will impact because there's downstream implications of any regulation in any given industry. And so economists supposedly could measure federal regulations over time and by industry and assess its implications on business. So for the first paper using the database, Tarabic looked at the effect of federal regulation on, quote, economic dynamism, which is the which is a term which refers to the rate at which new businesses launch and grow when people switch jobs, lose jobs, or move for work. And apparently there has been a notable and some say mysterious decline in dynamism over the last few decades. I wonder what happened over the last few decades. Well, we've talked about this on this program, but let's table that for a moment. The rate at which startups form is half of what it was 40 years ago. Some people say millennials, but wait, we will get to that. The fraction of workers who bounce from one job to another has plunged. That's a sign of competitive labor markets. It's plunged. Productivity has slowed. And adult unemployment remains well below its early 2000 peak. And it turns out that well, according to Tabarrok, I was pretty surprised that we just kept coming up with nothing. I'm a free market type of person, so it wouldn't have surprised me to find that government regulation is causing decline in dynamism. It fits my priors of the way I would see the world. So, yes, I was expecting to find something. However, it turns out they found nothing in regards to federal regulations. There was not only no causation, there wasn't even a correlation to federal regulation and this loss of dynamism. The premise that regulations come at the expense of economic activity is so pervasive, writes Rachel Cohen, that even the American left tends to accept it. But there has never been strong evidence that these trade-offs actually exist. Tabarrok said he's open to the theory that consolidation has hurt dynamism, but deeply skeptical that antitrust enforcement can fix it. So, in other words,
still found the answer they were looking for.
They couldn't figure out. It appears as if government regulation does not in any way inhibit economic dynamism. And now, I imagine in some instances it curtails profits, but in other instances, I imagine it increases profits for different people. With new regulation tends to be new industries that are created. Sometimes they find new products. Apparently, these electric cars are getting very exciting. CAFE standards are very helpful for people. Even these light bulbs, can you imagine?
Whoa.
Where would we be today without LEDs? Well, that was all because of those horrible government regulations about the light bulb, those onerous regulations. No, and there's no data out, or at least that that Tabarrok will accept. But there's a good reason to believe that the reason why you've seen less businesses grow is because because you have behemoths in all these industries. And that antitrust is the issue. And of course, he's a little bit skeptical that antitrust laws could stop that, but maybe he should do more research. But I just found that a heartwarming story because the idea of a libertarian looking at data and accepting data as opposed to just sort of a theory is something that we have never encountered at this program, even with academics.
Oh, no. Even, I would say, even potentially more so with some academics. Can I just add a little 30-second democratic blaming for this as well in terms of the story and the culture? I was doing some reading for a project or a show that we're going to do on TMBS, and Al Gore's Reinventing Government. He went on, I think it was like Letterman, to show him shredding government regulations. And this idea was that he was in charge of like this giant onerous project to, you know, get rid of and also fire a lot of members of the federal workforce.
Oh, in 92. Yes. I mean, this was all part of Bill Clinton's
the third way DLC stuff.
Yeah, this is all part of Bill Clinton's the era of big government is over. I mean, that's a quote of his. And that he was all in on that. And Gore was, among other things, appointed to that task force. They had a special name for it. I can't remember. But he also
reinventing government.
Yeah, there was also another one. He was also doing was basically creating the internet. But
right.
But yes, that was a 30 some odd years ago. And the Democratic Party, I think, has hopefully begun to shift. I mean, I mentioned the other day that. The Schatz, I'm not even remembering what context this came up, but Brian Schatz no longer feels like he has to justify the spending in his proposal. I think this came up with Tom Hartman. Schatz introduced a debt-free college proposal, and I'm more in favor of a free college, but nevertheless, he did not feel compelled to provide for a pay for. I mean, I think it's all part of the same attitude that Democrats are beginning to sort of come around there. But yes, Al Gore was definitely, and it was a Bill Clinton thing. They were the new Democrats.
We're new Democrats. Onerous regulations, like not being able to execute a retarded black guy.
Exactly. You don't want those.
By the way, that's also not a joke. Look it up. Pretty terrifying story.
He left the campaign in 92, I guess it was, to go back and oversee that capital punishment.
And remember what that guy said?
He said he thought he was going to get some
soup or
something.
He asked if he could save his meal
save his dessert for later.
He didn't understand at all what was happening to him.
Sick. No, it was horrible. Folks, Harry's founders know that a great shave comes down to great blades. They got to be sharp. They got to be durable steel that lasts. And that's why they make some of the highest quality blades in the world. However, they are priced much lower than the leading brand. And they will even give you a full refund if you don't love your shave, as long as you let them know within 30 days. And folks, if on day 31 you decide that your shave was not good, then you really got to get in touch with your face more.
Get in touch with your face.
Honestly. Harry stands behind the quality of their blades. Have you noticed, I'm not going to say any names, but have you noticed that some of the bigger outfits now are like boasting that their prices are coming down supposedly and that they're talking about their craftsmanship for the first time and as far as I can remember as an adult?
Anti-monopoly
company. Yeah, exactly. So Harry's created a $13 gift set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. They got the weighted ergonomic handle, the five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, travel blade cover. This is for $13 gift set. You can claim yours now by going to harrys.com/majority report. You know what I love best about Harry's? Well, there's three things, I would say. One is the handle. The handle's just, it doesn't feel like, all the other handles tend to be sort of like a gearish, a little bit like Rambo-y. This one I like. It's nicely designed. It's ergonomic, I guess. I'm not sure I would know what that means, but it feels better in my hand. When they moved to the trimmer blade, that was a big bonus for me because of my nasal situation. And, of course, I like the fact that it's significantly less expensive. You can now get your trial set at harrys.com/majority report. Go to harrys.com/majority report, redeem your offer, and let them know I sent you to support the show. All right, let's move on to what's going on in terms of Syria at this point. There was hopes that chemical weapons inspectors via the UN would be in Syria by now. The Syrians and Russians are apparently keeping the OPCW, that's the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, from visiting Douma. Understand, too, that the OPCW has not been allowed to assess where chemical weapons are coming from. Russia has prevented this in terms of, I think, UN resolutions. They're only allowed to assess whether or not there have been chemical weapons used. Now, with that said, the question, I said on, what was it, on Friday, when they were talking about imminent bombings, that the best case scenario that we could hope for in this context, I mean, the best case scenario, in my estimation, would be we do not use weapons to inhibit the use of weapons in this instance. However, in a more realistic sense, the best case scenario for me was let's drop a couple of missiles into the Mediterranean and say that we did something so that everybody can walk away and feel like, you know, they all have, they're well endowed and that no one's manhood is in any way questioned from this this whole expression.
Oh,
and
Jesus, thank God.
Thank God. Okay. Everybody, we're all intact. All right. And fortunately, it appears that's what's been done. It's as far as we know, there have been no reports of casualties. There has been no destruction of any sort of infrastructure that would in any way harm civilians. Maybe an empty factory and one end of a runway. It's unclear, but at the very least, no one is reporting any casualties. So, but for the fact that some folks out around Route 128 around Boston and probably a couple other places across the country make a little more cash because we've just expended, God knows, 150 school districts worth of budget in half an hour.
I bet more.
On a really meaningless act. I mean, look, if the theory goes, and I understand the argument that we don't want to, we want to discourage the use of chemical weapons because more often than not, chemical weapons are used against civilians. They are used to maintain the infrastructure, but just basically kill people. And so they are a weapon that is best suited towards killing civilians. And that is, presumably, the reason why we have such strong prohibitions against them. But nobody thinks it's a good idea to level a city, I mean, to kill civilians as a way of protecting them. Like, the threshold, and I don't, you know, we have no definitive evidence of who used this or that it existed. I of course, I don't have definitive proof that there is a war in Syria either. I haven't seen it. I've taken other people's word for it.
Wag the dog scenario here.
But if we stipulate that the Assad regime, and I wouldn't be surprised if they did, use this as a way of basically trying to close the deal with the Army of Islam to get them to leave Douma, which they did apparently like 12 hours later. We want to discourage this usage, but the idea that we wouldn't do a meaningless bombing would somehow communicate to Syria that next time, if it's really serious, we're going to do a real bombing. I just don't know why you need that. I don't know why we can't just sort of like go out into some uninhabited island and just blow that up and say, next time it's you.
May I say, you are getting a little suspiciously close to the Sheldon Adelson Iran proposal, but you're
right,
a lot more grounded in reality. Right. Where he said we should just drop a nuke in the middle of the Iranian desert. Don't hurt anybody.
Right.
But just let them know you mean business.
Well, I mean,
and then you realize this is a billionaire who runs essentially two governments in the world.
He doesn't know necessarily about the implications of the nukes. I'm just saying drop a Moab maybe on an island or something.
Oh,
and,
man, very bad for the ecology.
So. Yes. But the other major issue here is that there does not appear to be any legal justification for our bombing. Now, according to The Intercept, the Trump administration almost certainly does have a purported legal justification that would have been offered by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, but no one is allowed to read it, including apparently Congress. So maybe this will come out someday when we're all older, sitting with our grandchildren. There was an OLC opinion that was offered for the previous strike on Syria, which was about a year ago, almost to the day, April 6, 2017. We know that it exists because the organization Protect Democracy filed a lawsuit to compel the Justice Department to comply with a FOIA request. The OLC refused, but it did provide an index of the documents, basically saying, like, here's the document. We have it. You can't see it, but it exists. And in the Washington Post, Jack Goldsmith, who was a former OLC, I believe, lawyer, and Una Hathaway, basically ran down the potential arguments for the legal justification and found all of them wanting. The 2001 authorization use of military force, and it was funny, you know, I was watching some, I left Vegas very, very early in the morning. I think I had like a 6 a.m. flight, yes.
Oh, wow.
And
how brutal was that flight?
Not bad. I fell asleep
good
during
for you.
But I watched Fox. I think it was maybe on the plane, I think it was. And I'll tell you something. You know, all of these news stations, like the 5 a.m. folks, you have no idea who they are. And they feel like they've been brought on from like a local station so they can read the news. But synthesizing things, not necessarily in their wheelhouse. to watch the Fox version of these people is pretty hilarious. They're just getting completely confused about what the authorization for military force was. I mean, I don't think they understood. I saw some exchange. I wish we could have pulled it, but I couldn't. I can't for the life of me. It didn't sound like they understood that it was a thing. that it was like a specific thing, like a vote had been taken on different authorization for military force. They just thought it was a general principle that you could exercise at any time. Well, I mean, that's the way it's used.
Right, that is functionally what it is.
But I think that's why they understand. But they were just like, well, we could do this because of the authorization, because we're authorized to use military force.
We could do this because we live in a consequence-free world where the United States can exercise power pretty much at any time of its own discretion. Okay. Back to you, Mindy.
So there were two AUMFs. One was after 9/11, and it says that you can, which has been continued to be reauthorized, and I'm not terribly happy about that. The president is authorized to use force against nations, organizations, or persons with a link to the 9/11 attack. So Al-Qaeda, Taliban, until you are found to be a total liar, Saddam Hussein. The AUMF also extends to associated forces. So that could be allies of Al-Qaeda. It could be theoretically ISIS. Because it is a derivative of Al-Qaeda, theoretically. It could have been used against Al-Qaeda in Syria, or the Islamic State, I guess. But the idea of it being used against the Syrians themselves, no. Not at all. Just not even close. No one would even make that assessment. There is a 2002 AUMF. Which deals with Iraq, and it authorized the president to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate to defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq. You could say ISIS, maybe.
The disaster that we created in Iraq has literally spilled over into Syria, and ISIS does have a lot of both Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Ba'ath officers. That actually is the strongest circular
argument. So you could attack ISIS,
yeah,
but not Syria.
We did first start bombing them in Iraq, too. So I see the trend line there.
So apparently they have a secret OLC memo, and it could be something under Article 2 of the Constitution where you can use military force overseas to defend important U.S. national interests. And that's what maybe, let's listen to Donald Trump as he announces that we're going to bomb Syria. He tries to argue that, I don't know if he tries to argue, but
words
well,
are spoken.
Listen to how he explains it. He seems very determined in this.
A short time ago, I ordered the United States Armed Forces to launch precision strikes on targets associated with the chemical weapons capabilities of Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. A combined operation with the armed forces of France and the United Kingdom is now underway. We thank them both. Tonight, I want to speak with you about why we have taken this action. 1 year ago, Assad launched a savage chemical weapons attack against his own innocent people. The United States responded with 58 missile strikes that destroyed 20% of the Syrian Air Force.
Not really.
Last Saturday, the Assad regime again deployed chemical weapons to slaughter innocent civilians, this time in the town of Douma, near the Syrian capital of Damascus.
Okay, he goes on to say it's a vital national security interest of the United States to inhibit the use of chemical weapons. And that seems like a super stretch, that the use of chemical weapons against 700 Syrians is a threat to U.S. national security. If that is the case, then there is nothing that is not a threat to U.S. national security.
Right.
And therefore, there is no point in having Congress with the ability to wage war, because apparently the president can do it whenever he sees fit.
Where did you go to school? The University of Phoenix? I like the mind on you.
And
I can do whatever I want.
And here is the other issue. There is a, from in terms of international law, there is an authorization for some type of military response in terms of enforcing the 1997 Chemical Weapons Convention. However, there are specific protocols that must be met before you can invoke it. First, you need an investigation by the OPCW. That's the Organization for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. You need that investigation to provide some assuredness as to the use of chemical weapons and who might have used them. They're not even in Duma yet. Or Duma. Dharma, as the president called it.
Nailed it.
In situations of particular gravity, the Conference of State Parties may bring a matter to the attention of the UN General Assembly and Security Council, but there is no provision for a unilateral use of force in response to the breach of the convention. And I guess you could make an argument that this was a humanitarian intervention by the United Kingdom. But there's no exception to the UN Charter regime for humanitarian intervention. Theoretically, that is what the UN authorization for bombing of Libya was about, to prevent an imminent humanitarian crisis in Benghazi. And unfortunately, and I think that, you know, at the time I thought that was legitimate. And in theory, I think that's legitimate. The UN Security Council found that there was an imminent threat to Benghazi. And if you believe in that institutional, that international institution, I mean, that's supposed to be the way it works. Unfortunately, the countries tasked with providing the protection for those Benghazi citizens overstepped their mandate and basically went on to regime change. And it very well may be that they did so because Sarkozy didn't want to end up in prison.
Well, no. I really want to spell out that story for people because the accusation, which is like, I mean, he's, you know, been arrested and detained for. So it's like at least, you know.
And that means a little bit something different in France than it does in this country.
Right. It doesn't mean he did it, obviously, but it's also not just, it's not an Alex Jones story is the point I'm trying to make.
It's not an Alex Jones story, but we should also say, yeah. The word arrest in France does not mean what it means here.
Fair enough. And also, you know,
it's an indictment.
Yeah. And I'm totally skeptical of the Lula case in Brazil for what it's worth. But I'm, you know, more skeptical of Sarkozy. But the accusation is like millions of dollars in suitcases in a hotel. Not like a nice campaign contribution from the, you know, Gaddafi conglomerate. It's like literally like, and then Sarkozy being like, I don't think I really want that guy to tell that story.
That seems like a bad story for me.
We need to totally intervene in Benghazi, which is really gangster.
All right, let's catch up on what's going on with the teacher protests across the country. And this has been really encouraging. It started in West Virginia, and it spread to Arizona and Oklahoma and to Kentucky. Oklahoma teachers, as you know, won concessions from lawmakers amongst their walkout. They got raises, but they stayed out on strike to get more government funding for education, broadly speaking. They got basically, what was it, like $40 million, I think it was. Not much at all. But they basically said, all right, we're going to roll this up and we're gonna vote out. They've just, the union leader just, and I don't know, I think there's still some people out protesting, but the union leaders in Oklahoma have ended the 9-day statewide strike. There's, like I say, seeing a little bit of increase in funding for education. But basically, they said the union is going to focus on getting rid of the governor, I guess. They've got their 40 million. They're going to try and get the vote out. And I don't know if it's 2018 or 2020. I'm not sure when this Oklahoma gets out, but they feel like they have exhausted their means. It remains to be seen what the rank and file say. But
that's ringing some alarm bells for me. I mean, isn't that how the strike actions ended up petering out in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
Whenever you try to go the route of electoral politics, like why, like they have so much power to withhold their labor. Why would they not just keep going for it? You know?
Well, I mean, I think I don't know. I mean, my guess would be that they have assessed that they have played their cards for the time being. They got the $40 million. That's not enough in their minds, but this is as much as they're going to get right now.
Did you know that in some places in Oklahoma, school is down to 4 days a week now?
Yes, sweet. I did know that, actually.
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
People still have to work 5 or more days a week.
It's crazy. It's hard to know what the dynamic is in terms of how strong those associations are. I mean, the union there, I don't know how strong the union is, how much it has ability to provide for teachers who are out striking. I don't know. I don't know more of the details, to be honest with you. But yes, it does have some reminiscence to what the energy turned a little bit too quickly into electoral politics in Wisconsin. At least that's my feeling about that as well. But that's what's going on in Oklahoma. In Kentucky, there hasn't been quite, I don't know if I would call it strikes, but there's been protests. There's been some walkouts, maybe some sick outs. Matt Bevin, the governor there, apparently couldn't help himself. He's opposed these teachers' rallies. They want pension protection. Those disgusting
entitled bastards. Entitlement society.
They want increased public education funding. Oy. Just so greedy, these teachers. So greedy.
Imagine, I'm sorry. Imagine if he literally came out and was like, oi.
Oi, you're Bevin. So greedy.
Oi.
Well, here's what he came out to say. This is, he's so concerned about the children, folks. So concerned about the children.
The teachers from across the state.
I mean, the number, I saw a lot of people hanging out, shoes off, even early in the morning, hanging out, smoking, hanging out, leaving trash around, taking the day off.
Pause it. He's referring to the teachers. They're out there with their shoes off, smoking. Nobody in Kentucky smokes, incidentally. They're not like one of the top tobacco producing states in the country. But they're out there smoking, shoes off.
Teachers smoke.
Teachers smoke.
Littering.
Taking the day off. Taking the day off.
Polluting the environment.
Teaching kids how to smoke. Like, come here. Right. You got a day off because we're striking. Here's what you really do. You get yourself a government job and you smoke and you can do nothing, young man.
You know, here's what's crazy to me. You know how many hundreds of thousands of children today were left home alone? I guarantee you somewhere in Kentucky today, a child was sexually assaulted that was left at home because there was nobody there to watch them. I guarantee you somewhere today, a child was physically harmed or ingested poison because they were home alone because a single parent didn't have any money to take care of them. I'm offended by the idea that people so cavalierly and so flippantly disregarded what's truly best for children. You know how many children live in urban communities and rural communities where there's a single parent who literally, if they could afford to skip work and not lose their job, they couldn't afford to because they need the money. They don't have a backup for them. They don't get paid whether they go to work or not. They don't have an option. And some of them were given literally a matter of hours. So you know for a fact that there were hundreds of thousands of children who were left unattended, and some of them in communities where people knew that for a fact and took advantage of it. And as surely as we're having this conversation, children were harmed, some physically, some sexually. Some were introduced to drugs for the first time because they were vulnerable and left alone. It's offensive, frankly. It really is. If you want to write a story, that's the kind of thing you guys should talk about.
And now is when he launches into a heartfelt cry for paid sick leave for single parents, where he looks for support for families who are living and not able to take a day off. In fact, he wants to expand a whole suite of laws and protections for workers so that in situations like this, they're empowered to take care of their children. No, sorry. In fact, I would bet that it's almost impossible for someone to point to a single piece of legislation that this guy has signed or promoted that helps any of the people he mentioned, any of the people, survivors of sexual assault, keeping drugs out of the hands of kids or drug education or, support for single parents. Or I bet there is not a single piece of legislation that he has ever supported or signed or even discussed that has any impact on any of those people that would be helpful in any respect to those people.
This is so illustrative, though, because for Republicans, I'm sure people have picked up on this, but the only time that you will ever hear them talk about people dealing with structural poverty as an example or any of the things that he mentioned in that litany that isn't the product of their social, personal, or genetic, indeed. Now we're back to freaking genetic defects. The only time they will address a social cause that the people who are victims of structural inequity are the result of is when they're attacking teachers. That is the only time that you will ever hear what he just said as like not, you know, irresponsible single mothers who can't handle themselves neglecting their kids. That's the only other time you'll hear that. But when it comes to the teachers, then it's like you got these overworked, impoverished families and the teachers are just letting them down.
For instance, in terms of Matt Bevin, here's a heartwarming story about Matt Bevin caring about those people back all the way back in almost 2 months ago. Kentucky governor countersues over Medicaid work requirements. He's stopping a lawsuit filed by critics of the state's plans to institute Medicaid work requirements. He's so concerned about those single mothers who are there with kids that are getting health care that if they're not out of the house leaving their kids at home, right? They're young kids at home. He's actually like countersuing.
Oh my God. He's going to do a Paul Ryan. He's going to say that some elementary school kid, we came up to him. He was just like, you know, the kids who get private insurance feel so much better about themselves.
Yeah, exactly.
I want a packed lunch in private insurance because Medicaid just makes me feel out of the system. Like I'm not really working for it. I want to earn my own inhaler.
They just don't have the ability to have the pride in having privately provided health insurance.
Pride of Humana.
Offensive. Totally offensive. It's going to be interesting to see what the implications of these teacher strikes are going to be as we go forward. I mean, one, I think it's like broadly empowering the labor movement. It's also providing, particularly in these states, some form of template for the reality that we're going to see come June, I guess, when we get a decision from the Supreme Court on Janus, which is where you have teachers unions and public sector unions that are not that are working in non-closed shops, and you're going to have unions negotiating on behalf of a lot of people who are not paying for that service. In Kentucky, you had lawmakers just on Friday overriding Matt Bevin's veto of a 2-year state budget that increases public education spending with a $480 million tax increase. I mean, it gives you a sense of what the politics are here. And Kentucky teachers have not asked for a raise. They just want the day off so they can go out and smoke and take their shoes off.
I don't want a raise, man. I just want less responsibility to educate our youth.
But they want the pensions they were promised. And remember,
what slobs?
Yeah, disgusting. Disgusting. Just absolutely disgusting. Oh, you've taught for 30 years and you think you deserve some type of like dignified retirement?
I just want you to honor your contracts, man.
Yeah, right. Honor your contracts. Incidentally, understand that these pensions are simply deferred compensation. That's all it is. And it's a break for the employer.
And by the way, wasn't that one of the reasons that we couldn't claw back bonuses when we were bailing out Wall Street?
Right.
Because of
contractual
obligations.
Contractual things for AIG are too sacrosanct.
Literally for people who committed fraud, the reason was contractual obligation.
They're also interested in education funding, broadly speaking. So that's disgusting.
More Play-Doh for when we're high, man.
The best part is it's the raise in taxes, 50-cent increase in the cigarette tax. So on one hand, Bevin's going to see a lot less people out there smoking when they protest him next time.
I'm kind of tired of, I don't even smoke, but I feel like smokers just, they're asked to bear the burden of everything. Just raise some taxes on some goddamn financiers and let the smokers have a break. Jesus.
Well, it's probably good in terms of knocking off the
fair enough
the use of those. Everybody switched to vaping anyways now. Yeah. That's what's happening.
Probably not in Kentucky, buddy.
Yeah. Not in Kentucky so much. So good for the teachers, and hopefully this this spreads. I mean, now it's been basically in the states that have had the most draconian cuts to education and the lowest teacher salaries across the country, places like West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, and Kentucky. But hopefully we'll see this spread a little bit more. And I hopefully there are, you know, national teachers union folk who are going in and getting ideas for that can be spread to other unions across the country in terms of the way that these unions are building relationships in the community. Because at the end of the day, this is the most important thing, is that you have broad-based support that is outside of the specific industry that you're working in. Not just labor support in terms of other unions, but of citizens' support. And that's the whole idea behind social movement unionism, is to get the union to build some solidarity with other folks who are working on other issues that, you know, may at first seem totally tangential, but are in fact, you know, intricate to a broader struggle. So,
hell yeah,
all good stuff there. I wanted to just, let's see what else I had.
Did you want to do a little levity soon?
Yeah, in a moment, we're going to head into the fun half. But there was just one thing I just wanted to point out since we were talking about education, which is also sort of, you know, during the, just a quick hit here, during the Obama years, and Corey Robin had a tweet, I think this is before a couple weeks, maybe the week before we went on vacation, wondering, and maybe wrote a piece or linked to a piece, about why there seems to be much broader base support amongst the Democratic Party for these teachers' movements in 2018, as opposed to, I think it was 2011, with the Chicago teachers' strike. I think there's there was a bunch of reasons for that. Not the least of which was that Chicago was so closely associated with Obama. It was Arne Duncan and Rahm Emanuel. But I also think a big part of it is that the so-called education reform movement has been both uncovered and in many respects, I think, has lost. This, I got no problem with education reform. But the education reform movement that has been the self-proclaimed education reform movement has really been a corporate movement driven by corporate money. In some instances, I would imagine, being quite sincere, but applying corporate metrics to improving education as opposed to educational metrics and having educators do it. I mean, here, and this was the, you know, I remember in 2012, 2011, 2013 on this program, we had a lot of educators on to push back. And one of the things that became very clear to me is that, you know, from the corporate education reform, it was very easy for them to sloganize what they were looking for. Because in the corporate world, you have a very narrow set of metrics in which you measure success. And they're usually literally metrics. Written, you know, numbered metrics. And every educator that we would have come on would say, like, oh yeah, the problem with this type of education reform is that it wants it to all be apples to apples. And the whole point of education is that you don't just have apples and apples in a class. You have apples and oranges and bananas and grapes, and you have all sorts of different types of students. And each student requires something that is different, and that the genuine skill about of an educator, whether it's a teacher or someone who is designing an education system, is to be able to apply certain broad principles, but very uniquely based upon the needs of the students. And that is not a great slogan for a bumper sticker. However, I think what is really clear is that the veneer is off the education reform movement, and parents and teachers have struck back against the idea of high-stakes testing and the idea of using these sort of very narrow one-dimensional metrics. And just as an example, there were Colorado Democrats gathered in Broomfield, Colorado, Saturday, for the Democratic State Assembly. And delegates there basically drove the Democrats for Education Reform movement out of their party. They booed the head of the Education Reform Organization. I'm not in favor of booing teachers, but I understand the idea. They booed the teacher who came up speaking from a charter school.
Tim Kanoff, boo.
Tim Kanoff. The advisory committee of the Colorado chapter of Democrats for Education Reform reads like a who's who of prominent party members. Includes former Speaker of the State House, Mark Ferrandino. The former State Senate, Mike Johnston, a Democratic governor and the author of several key education reform bills in Colorado. And that first guy also works for Denver Public Schools. But the platform amendment reads, we oppose making Colorado's public schools private or run by private corporations or becoming segregated again through lobbying campaigning efforts of the organization called Democrats for Education Reform, and demand that they immediately stop using the party's name Democrat in their name. That's powerful. Yeah. So, and you know, Colorado is one of those states that was very much like school choice happy, and that's a purple state. Good to see that there. So hopefully that has a broader...
But like that, very smart I am or intuitive, some of the most progressive things are going to happen in more purplish states where there's less of a machine. And that's another reason why, you know, Cynthia Nixon is... And where people... Well, people are being squeezed everywhere. But I mean, Cynthia Nixon, I do want to take a moment to plug her. I think that's, again, that's super important.
Well, we're going to talk about this. But what the Working Families Party, and as you know, the Working Families Party back in 2014, 4 years ago. I think it was 2014. They were toying with the idea of running, and this is not an endorsement, they were actually going to run Zephyr Teachout on the Working Families Party ticket. And at that time, I found myself sitting in a room with about 30 or 40 leaders of advocacy groups. There were no unions there. It was an informal situation where people were meeting to talk about whether or not they wanted to challenge Cuomo. I mean, I didn't have anything to say. I was more observing. And I was amazed at the advocacy groups who rely on state funding, who are like, yes, challenge Cuomo. If we get Astorino, Rob Astorino, who was the Republican who was going to run and ultimately did, they said, that's going to stink. But the fact is that Cuomo is worse. And I was shocked by that. Now, it turned out at the time, I think what was going on, Working Families, the Working Families Party is... has been very much a function of union support. CWA, SIEU, very big part of the Working Families Party. And at the time, I think they were concerned about trying to move ahead without the support of these unions. Because in New York, it's very transactional. And literally, the governor can destroy a union. And that is what he threatened this time. If the Working Families Party endorsed Cynthia Nixon in her run against Cuomo in the Democratic primary. Now, remember, the Working Families Party decided not to run Zephyr Teachout. She then made a decision that she was going to run in the Democratic primary. She did so without the formal support of the Working Families Party. She pulled in 37% of the vote. Most of it was from upstate. Cynthia Nixon is looking to do better downstate in New York City. And getting the Working Families Party endorsement means two things. And they certainly knew, the Working Families Party certainly knew, that the CWA, the Communication Workers of America, and the SEIU would walk away from the Working Families Party. Now, I have a feeling it might be some, there'll be a day when they come back. But they have left the Working Families Party, and the Working Families Party still went ahead, their rank and file endorsed Cynthia Nixon, and it's also an indication that the Working Families Party feels strong enough with their relationships to advocacy groups and whatnot that they don't need the unions to exist. So if you have the opportunity to support the Working Families Party, do so, because right now they were probably going to need it. Here is an example of a couple of, I guess, Craig T. Nelson. I don't know who that is on...
He's extremely online. Twitter account, but it doesn't matter. The substance is right.
A well-known Twitter account has...
That really is the best way to describe
I know. I mean, I know him, but I don't know who he is or she is.
Nobody does.
Well, that's... Okay, so...
He's our QAnon.
There's all coded. It's even a... Before Cynthia Nixon... Cuomo says he remains opposed to recreational marijuana. That's in February 8th of 2017. On April 12th, 2018, Cuomo lays groundwork for legalizing marijuana. This is after, literally after a week from Cynthia Nixon saying it in a, and there was a story about this. It's at Isabel Gillies' house. Isabel Gillies held a fundraiser for her. And she commented then that she came out publicly and said that she was supporting legalization of marijuana. Cuomo has done a, maybe I wouldn't say a 360. I would say probably closer to a 180 is really. He's done more of like a 170. He's almost there, 160. Same thing with the IDC. On October 24th, 2010, Cuomo vows offensive against labor unions. And now in 2018, Cuomo signs a bill that gives unions more power to recruit members despite Supreme Court case. This is the CWA and SEIU probably facing the prospect of a post-Janus world in some respects.
Didn't he later go to a private fundraiser for the IDC after he publicly said that they weren't going to be a thing anymore?
I think that... there's reason to be skeptical. And he said this back in the day, too. One of the things that he supposedly had promised the Working Families Party back then in 2014 was that he was going to, you know, campaign against them. But we'll see. And 2017, Governor Cuomo decides he actually doesn't run the MTA. And now, April 7th, $800 million for repairs will help the subway get up and going, says Cuomo. He is. There's no doubt. There's no doubt. And you're already seeing stories. There's no doubt that that Cuomo, that in many ways, Cynthia Nixon has already won. But Cuomo is afraid, not necessarily of losing, although he could be afraid of losing. Cuomo is afraid of getting, doing worse. He was afraid of getting less than 60% or, you know, less than 70% when he was going against Zephyr Teachout. And 37% really hurt him. Because this is a guy who wants to run for president, and he can't even consolidate the Democrats in New York State. And if he, if Cuomo, let me say this, let me put it this way. If Cuomo doesn't win with a greater margin against Cynthia Nixon than he did with Zephyr Teachout, even he may realize that his presidential aspirations are delusions. That's how bad it is for him. But
I
listen,
like that.
It's not inconceivable. It's not even, it's not inconceivable. I mean, it's a stretch, but it's not inconceivable that Cynthia Nixon could win. She has much greater name recognition. There is much more sort of broader understanding of Cuomo. New York City is now in the hands of somebody who is not a a Cuomo fan. In the form of
the man who stuck
de Blasio.
His neck out for him last time. That's another part of the story as well.
And
de Blasio helped protect him from this scenario when it was Zephyr Teachout and got repaid with endless humiliations and attempt at undermining. So it's like, it's not only that there's bad blood, it's like the scenario playing out a second time with worse blood.
And do not underestimate the implications of the Working Family Party. The Working Families Party's success in running Working Family Party only, because mostly it's a fusion ticket in this state. So people can run, Democrats can run on the Working Family Party. But when you look to the city council in New York, you've got a couple of new Working Family Party. That is, they're not running as a fusion ticket. They're not Democrats running on the Working Family Party line. They're Working Family Party candidates. So the power of the Working Family Party is pretty strong in downstate, in New York City. And that's going to make the difference in this election if Cynthia Nixon's going
to
win.
I mean, Cuomo definitely deserves to lose to her or somebody, but I kind of want to tamp down on expectations a little bit for how progressive Cynthia Nixon herself would be. Not only because, I mean, she could be, you know, intending to be very progressive, but she doesn't have the institutional power in Albany in order to make her ideas go through. Also, she said something pretty shady about unions that I guess they're playing off as a gaffe, but perhaps is how she really feels when she said the unions have to understand with the deals they have now, you can't hope to make improvements to the trains in a fiscally responsible way. Everybody's got to pull together and everybody's got to make sacrifices. And when a politician says sacrifices about anyone but the 1%, that kind of sets alarm bells off in my head.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think your first point is well taken. I mean, if she gets up to New York, she's not going to have any institutional support, although the Working Families Party and theoretically the Democrats, if she becomes the Democratic nominee. But yes, I don't. I mean, I'm a little bit surprised about that with the unions. But I will
very
examine
dumb
that more.
And shady comment. Still very much worth supporting.
Do without a doubt. Andrew Cuomo is a horrible human being.
Like at this point, I will definitely vote for her, but I don't know if I'm going to canvass for her, you know?
Okay, fair enough. Meanwhile,
do this without that canvas, Cynthia.
Yes.
I mean, I think a lot of people feel the same way.
Maybe.
It's not just me.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half
Many
of the program.
People are saying.
A lot of people are saying
A lot of people are saying that they're supportive, but they won't canvass for it. You hear it all over. My friend Chuck
won't go to Paris, won't canvass for Cynthia Nixon. A lot of people are saying it.
Oh, we've been talking about it in the DSA.
Many people. DSA, too, by the way.
Over that one comment?
No.
What else?
I mean, we have a systemic critique of political parties.
Your scene with her in Sex and the City was pretty disgusting to people.
I understand.
That was also
a
problem.
There's that.
Well, okay. So there's nobody in the Democratic Party who would garner full support in a primary, in a Democratic primary.
Well,
or maybe, I don't know.
We've been debating that at the moment, so I might have a better answer for you soon.
Okay. All right, fair enough. This is the death knell of incrementalism.
Mm.
I mean, this is, I mean, I definitely agree, obviously, without the institutional support, it's very difficult. Although Working Families Party has, you know, it's pretty good as far as it goes in New York.
That's a scalp that's worth getting. Pick your pressure points and, you know, I think start trying to make those more sort of bold decisions when there's actually a real power base to do it from. It's like so speculative, you know. It's definitely worth, even if it's minimal amount of energy, the shock waves of him actually losing would be really significant in and of itself.
But we will, more to come on that. I will be canvassing for her.
Yeah. Can we do a reunion scene? That's what you should do. Well, you should ask if you can do a little reunion.
I'm going to be saying, like, you should vote for Cynthia Nixon. She's great in episode 415. Do you remember the one that you went to California? Well,
by the way, that would be a not a bad some type of, you could maybe make that at some type of spot, actually.
It's true, actually. Yes.
Not a bad idea.
If we ever
we've chewed this steak before, and it tastes horrible. Spit out Andrew Cuomo.
If we ever see you do that in real life, we will know that there's something very wrong with you.
Andrew Cuomo?
Oh,
oh no.
Right, we're going to take a quick break. We've got sound from the Scaramouche, who's very, very upset about Comey referring to... I don't quite get what his, I don't, he said it was like a mafiosa and he
it's
didn't.
A mob boss. That's an Italian slur.
That's
what I call Italians.
It's a slur against the Italian people.
Look at that mob boss over there.
All right, we'll talk about this. It's just weird. He calls Trump a mob boss and Scaramouche says that's an anti-Italian slur.
Well, I think it was another part in the book where James Comey said that even though he's not the president, it came off like a Dago Guinea wop, and it was an out-of-body experience being so close to such a greaseball who probably was to F his daughter, which I thought was very uncharacteristic of James Comey.
Yeah. And Alex Jones, this guy... Alex Jones, it's sort of, there's a weather vane. If you want to see where the Republican grift or the right-wing grift is going, he may be the first guy. It's not always an accurate report, but, and then, of course, we have a couple of Comey and anti-Comey vids. All this and more in the fun half of the program. Hey, I hope you enjoyed the Majority Report today. It was presented by Smart News. Say goodbye to fake news, nasty trolls, and the filter bubble of your social networks, folks. Get your news in 1 minute from 300 trusted media sources with Smart News. It is available for free in the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store. Smart News, one word. And folks, don't forget justcoffee.coop. 30%, you don't need a coupon code, 30% off all of their coffee offerings. So if you wanted to try a coffee, if you wanted to get a 5-pound bag, if you wanted to get multiple 5-pound bags, now is the time to do it. As you can see, we have right there in the corner of the office, right there, we should probably even take a shot of that. We have, here, bring those over here. Bring those over here. We're going to cut this as an ad. Right now, bring those over here. We have two. Count them, two. And I screwed up. I forgot that we... Yeah, bring. I want both of them over here. Oh, yeah. Come on. Look. Here is Majority Report 5-pound bag one. And Majority Report 5-pound bag two. And this one is the whole bean. This one I had ground because I forgot that we have a grinder. So we got to get through this one quick because these will last. So there it is. 30% off at Just Coffee this month. You don't have to buy a 5-pound bag, or you could buy just a bunch of small bags and see which one you like so that when we go forward with our promotion in the other months, 10% off, you could do it that way.
Yum, yum.
Just Coffee.
That drop made me feel high.
Don't forget, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Tomorrow night is TMBS. Who do you have on it this week, Michael?
Benjamin Dixon and Brendan Sutton.
And you can find that on iTunes, The Michael Brooks Show, or check it out on our YouTube page. Also, Jamie's Patreon, now featuring new and improved Patreon, now featuring episodes of Antifada at patreon.com/JamiePeck. But of course, writings are available for everybody.
Yeah, we should be in the iTunes store by Wednesday, so that's exciting.
So this is, you can get the jump on all of this by heading over to that Patreon account. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. We'll be back in a moment with the fun half.